So we're going to be studying about Shlomo HaMelech and about his time period and the time period in which he ruled. And at least the way the Tanakh presents the life of Shlomo, first of all, Shlomo gets a lot less attention in the Tanakh than David. Shlomo's life is covered by, I believe it's 11 chapters in the book of Malachim Aleph and a similar amount in the book of Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Divrei Hayamim Bet. Much of which is a direct parallel to Malachim. Of course, we also have three books that were written by Shlomo in the Tanakh as well, Shir HaShirim and Mishlei, which have his name, and Kohelet, which doesn't have his name, but according to rabbinic tradition, is also written by him. And hopefully we'll have a chance to look a little bit at those books as well. So not only does the Tanakh spend less, does he have less press time, so to speak, given to him? But the Tanakh gives us less of an insight into Shlomo's own individual personality and more about his life seems to, at least the way the Tanakh presents it, much more closely tied in with the life of the entire nation. So we're going to be looking at the time period during which, the 40-year period during which Shlomo ruled. And that 40-year period, quite arguably, is the highest point that the Jewish people have reached to date in history. I don't want to say ever, because there is the belief and the hope and the aspiration that we will one day not only, one of the things we'll talk about is that we may again be poised to approach such a period for the first time pretty much since Shlomo's time, and hopefully ultimately to surpass it. But to date, those 40 years were perhaps the greatest 40 years in the entire history of the Jewish people. What do I mean when I say that? So if you look at these sources on the page here, Shlomo HaMelech presided over the nation at a time where, first of all, there was peace and tranquility. From the moments of our existence, from the very first moments of our existence, we've had enemies who've attacked us. We came out of Mitzrayim and were immediately attacked just a few days later, and those attacks did not cease at any point until the period of David, when David basically had defeated all the enemies around him. And the process started by David reached its culmination under Shlomo. And here, if you have just here, well, God willing, look at all these psukim in greater detail, but right now I just want to take a sort of an overview. First of all, the pockets of resistance that had remained within the land of Israel, the local nations that were constantly causing problems. Kol ha'am hanotar min ha'emori ha'chiti ha'prizi ha'chivi v'ayvusi asher lo mibnei Yisrael hema. B'neihem asher notru achareihem ba'aretz, those who remained after all these other people. Asher lo yachlu b'nei Yisrael achrimam, those who still hadn't been eradicated from the land. Shlomo ruled over them. V'ya'alem Shlomo lemas oved alayom hazeh, they were completely subjugated. And not only did he rule solidly and completely over the entire land of Israel, and the land of Israel, which has had different borders at different points in time, nothing changes, and the same issues we're struggling with now, where are the borders of our country, were issues that our ancestors struggled with too. But under Shlomo's reign, the land of Israel's borders expanded. Shlomo was one of the few kings in the time of the First Temple or the Second Temple whose reign, in terms of the land of Israel itself, reached as far south as Eilat. And it says explicitly in the Psukim, this is Malachim Aleph, it's Perek Tet, that one's not on the sheet, that's one Pasuk, it's not crucial to look at it inside, but just to point out, Malachim Aleph, Perek Tet, Pasuk, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong book. Pasuk Chavav Va'ani, Ani Milashon Oniot, a fleet of boats. Asa HaMelech Shlomo Be'etzion Gever Asheret Eilot. That's Eilat, or someplace near the, probably closer to the Jordanian city of Aqaba today, but right there. Al Sfat Yam Suf Be'eretz Edom Va'yishlach Chiram Ba'oni Et Avadav Anshei Oniot Yodei Hayamim Avdei Shlomo, with his alliance that he made with Chiram Melech Tzor, which we'll talk about as well. They built a fleet of boats, and Vayavo Ophira, they began by having access to the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. That opened up a whole other area of trade in order to expand the economic power of the country, so to speak. So the rule over the land of Israel, which had begun in, and we'll talk about it briefly in a few minutes in greater detail, the rule over the land of Israel, which had begun in previous generations, was solidified under Shlomo, both from a military perspective, and we'll talk about it in a minute, also from an economic perspective. But also he ruled over neighboring countries as well, and actually could be called an emperor, who ruled over a vast empire. Ki hu rodeh b'chol eiver, the second source of the page there, Malachim Aleph Perkei, ki hu rodeh b'chol eiver ha-nahar mi Tifsach. Tifsach is somewhere in today's northern Syria. We add Aza, all the way down to Aza, and assumingly that means also the area ruled by the city of Aza, which extended down into the Sinai desert, b'chol malchei eiver ha-nahar, v'shalom hayalo mikol avarav misaviv. Vayeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael avetach, Ish tachat gafno v'tachat te'inato midan v'ad be'er sheva kol yimei Shlomo. So we have a king who's a Jewish king who's sitting in Yerushalayim, ruling over an empire that in today's terms comprises most of the Middle East. Okay, if you look at the borders described here, we're talking about something to the effect of part of the Sinai desert, which is today, of course, controlled by Egypt. The entire state of Israel today, including the so-called Palestinian territories, the entire country of Lebanon, the entire country of Jordan, much of Syria, a tiny bit of Turkey, and part of Iraq. That's what we're talking about.
Wow.
Okay? All under the reign of Shlomo, peace and tranquility, and in the heartland of the country, Midan v'ad be'er sheva, ish tachat gafno v'tachat teinato, everyone living comfortably and quietly, able to live their own private lives in peace and in tranquility. He also established diplomatic relations with the other major powers of the time. We'll talk about the fact that he married... Yeah?
Isn't Ishtachat Gafnatachat Tenata a negative reference from Shoktim?
It can be.
But here it's positive?
I think so. Well, that's part of what we'll have to talk about. Listen, certainly the context is positive. The question is whether pulling that phrase up is, you know, is hinting at something beneath the surface. That's what we're going to get to also. One of the major questions is not only what was accomplished, but I'm just going to get to that in a few minutes, what went wrong? Because as soon as Shlomo... Well, let's give ourselves 5 minutes of glory and then we'll talk about the problems. But it could very well be. It could very well be that there's some kind of a, an underlying current there that's being hinted at. There are other psukim also that if you look carefully, you know, in the midst of the descriptions of the glory and splendor, there may be hints at the cracks that ultimately, you know, cause the foundations to crumble.
So when he was emperor of this kind of this whatever you want to call it, empire, there were their own governing governments as well in Syria, Turkey, Iraq. Or
yeah, well, it says here that they were lamas of vayalim. Actually, that pasuk is. Actually, I see. It's not in the pasuk I'm going to give you here. Yeah, they were paying. They had to pay tribute. In other words, they have a local king who is subjected to the rule of a greater empire. That's what was done in the ancient world. Later on in our history, we often were in that situation, both in the times of Bayit Rishon, Melech Hizkiyahu, and many other kings had to pay tribute to other countries. And later on, of course, you know, in the time of the Persians and then the Greeks. And so, but at this point, it was Shlomo who was ruling over the others, so ruled directly over the land of Israel. And again, the land of Israel with expanded borders. And then, a sphere of influence of countries paying tribute and, you know, acknowledging his supreme rule, established, you know, stretching far, far and wide, you know, beyond.
We can talk about what that meant, his rule. You know, okay, we were under Roman rule, so we had to live Roman laws, and that often meant religious persecution. So, I mean, there was paganism at the time, there were other things at the time.
So that's an interesting question. I don't know to what extent we have historical information on that. That's a question I don't know the answer to. I also do know that there's a fascinating halachic and perhaps philosophical question. Definitely, hello. That's quite all right. There's a halachic, significant halachic debate about what is the responsibilities. I'm sorry, this is here. To what extent is a Jewish king obligated or intended or supposed to or allowed to impose what types of laws? You know, certainly when we speak about Jewish law, there's no concept of imposing what we call Taryag Mitzvot. But the question is. Correct, exactly,
well,
exactly.
Like, I'm interested to know what was going on.
So I'm not sure that I have an answer to that question right now. I'm not sure that anyone has an answer to that question right now. But certainly, the relationship between, and we're getting far ahead of ourselves, right? But the relationship between Shlomo's kingdom and those among whom he ruled, and the question of who's going to influence whom, right? In other words, are we ultimately, you know, is being under the rule of Shlomo going to cause monotheism and the messages of the Torah to be accepted by those nations, or on the contrary, are their values going to infiltrate us? There we have already an explicit reference at the end of Shlomo's life, right, via his wives that we'll talk about, and, you know, so I'm not sure what the answer is on a factual level, but that may even be less significant than the conceptual level, so that's definitely something to talk about as well. But again, right now we're still trying to take an overview, all right? Okay, right. 5 minutes of glory. Okay, so first of all, military power, expanded borders, peace, tranquility. Ish tachat gafno v'tachat teinato. Not a bad thing. I should everyone to have a little garden and a little, right?
If that's what it means. And Shoftim, maybe there are
right, okay.
That indicate.
Right, so you know, that's the question,
that
right? Exactly. Okay, so we'll see. Yeah, a pasuk that I didn't put on the page, but the beginning of that chapter, I put there Melechem Aleph just to answer your question. Perek Hay begins with. Ushlomo haya moshel bechol ha-mamlachot min ha-nahar eretz plishtim v'yad gvul mitzrayim magishim mincha. These nations, these foreign nations, had to pay tribute v'ovdim et Shlomo. That means not only to pay taxes and perhaps also to supply manpower for, which is also a form of taxation, but also to accept the supreme rule, to acknowledge themselves as subservient, commonwealth, whatever term you want to use, kol yimei chayav.
Does that mean they have to provide military? Like their sons also went to the army? Or
well, at least, we'll see that, at least civilian service, we'll see. But workers and... okay, you could call it that. Providing labor for the massive building projects of Shlomo, and we'll see all that inside as well. Okay. And again, besides the countries over whom he ruled directly, he also established diplomatic relations with the major powers of the time. We'll see that he married the daughter of Paro, which is an extremely significant political marriage, signifying an alliance with one of the great world superpowers of the time. He had an alliance with Hiram Melech Tzor, which is the Phoenician Empire, just north of the area that he ruled directly. We know the famous story of the Malkat Shva, the Queen of Sheba, as she's called in English, who came from a faraway land, probably somewhere where Yemen is today. Contrary to popular myth and other religions' traditions, it does not say in the Tanakh that he married her. It does not say that at all. But it does say that she came and that assumedly there was some sort of diplomatic and economic arrangements. In other words, we're talking about a massive world superpower who has relations... massive influence far beyond the borders of his own country.
You could use them now.
Yeah. Okay. A period of economic prosperity. We saw already a little bit of an indication of it. Again, I don't want to spend the time now looking inside. Hopefully, we'll get to them. But the Tanakh goes to lengths to describe the royal court in terms of its splendor and glory, and even the physical the throne that Shlomo built for himself, and the zoo that he built in Yerushalayim, right, with exotic animals from around the world. He wanted to turn Yerushalayim into a world class. I'm studying tourism now. I understand this a little bit. Seriously though, to create a capital city that people from all over the world would want to come to see, with all sorts of attractions and all sorts of and the lavish meals that were served in the royal palace, and all of these things, all are indications of an economic superpower, together with, of course, the military superpower that he built. And at the center of it all stood the Beit HaMikdash that Shlomo built. And that therefore it's very clear that this wasn't simply about military and political and economic power, but it was about exactly what the Jewish people are supposed to do, which is to use the political, military, and economic power for spiritual goals. And he built a massive and elaborate Beit HaMikdash that is less well known than the second Beit HaMikdash. We have a lot more information about the second one due to the fact that some remnants of it still remain archaeologically and various other things. But the truth is that there is a very detailed description in the Tanakh of the first Beit HaMikdash, and I hope to spend some time looking at that as well. And not only the physical structure of the Beit HaMikdash, but the purposes that it was meant to serve, which Shlomo also, in a very lengthy speech, lays out for us, and included in that is a very clear declaration of the fact that the Beit HaMikdash is not a Jewish temple, but it is a temple for the entire world. V'gam el hanochri, asher lo me'am cheYisrael hu, asher yavo me'eretz rechoka, which is mentioned, and we'll see, is devoted, Shlomo devotes an entire section of his speech to that.
How are they supposed to worship?
They can bring korbanot. There are korbanot that can be brought by a non-Jew. They cannot enter all the way into the Beit HaMikdash, neither can the rest of us. There are different places. There are places that only Kohanim can go, and there are places that Jews can go that non-Jews cannot. But the function, the cons, and there are certain types of sacrifices that they can bring in. They can bring an olah, not a shlamim. But the point is that they can come to the Beit HaMikdash to worship God the same as everyone else can, in the same way, to stand there in awe of the divine presence, Moram Mikdash, and to bring sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash.
And the Kohanim would.
Yeah, 100%. It's explicit in the halacha. And it's explicit here. We'll see. Shlomo himself is described, of course, as the wisest of all men. The phrase Chochmat Shlomo, the wisdom of Solomon, is an expression that has, become a pitgam. How do you say that in English? An expression, a cliche, something of that nature, and it's based on these psukim here, the third psukim on the sheet. Vayitein Elohim chochma leShlomo tvuna harbe meod. God granted Shlomo wisdom and understanding. Virochav leiv kachol shel sfat hayam. Same expression used to describe the numerous multitudes that were promised as descendants to Avram is now described. Not referring to people, but referring to the depth and breadth of Shlomo's wisdom. But Tereb Chochmat Shlomo Michol Bnei Kedem Umichol Chochmat Mitzrayim VaYechkam Michol HaAdam MeEtan HaEzvachi VeHeman VeChalkol B'Darda Bnei Michol. It's a fascinating pasuk that I hope to look at a little bit in greater detail when we get to it. That Shlomo was even wiser than the people that were known to be the wisest people, the wise people of Egypt, and certain individual people whose names may sound a little bit familiar, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that when we get to there. But for now, Vayhi Shmo Bechol Agoyim Saviv, his fame and reputation were known in all the nations in the region. And again, we know that Malkat Shva, the queen of Shva, came from far away just to see Shlomo and the great capital that he built, and to meet this person who was considered so impressive. Vayidaber shloshet alafim mashal vayhi shiro chamisha va'alef. He was the author of proverbs and the author of poems. Perhaps this refers to some of what's found at least in Shira Shirim and in Mishlei and perhaps in Kohelet. Maybe there were other things that we no longer have. Vaydaber al ha'itzim min ha'erez asher balvanon ve'ad ha'izov asher yotze bakir. Vaydaber al ha'beima ve'al ha'of ve'al ha'remes ve'al ha'dagim. He spoke about trees and animals. Assumedly this means that he had some understanding of how the world works. I don't know if this is talking about a scientific understanding. He understood biology and zoology. I was just talking about how, in fact, I'm studying a little bit of these things now, and I'm starting to understand that there is a lot of wisdom in fields that I never paid attention to before. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it's talking about. Maybe it's talking about something spiritual. I don't know exactly what it means, but again, there's something here being said about how this is an individual person whose depth of knowledge and comprehension of the world is unique, singular, and greater than any other person. And here as well, he used all of that, all of the fame that came from his wisdom and knowledge, for the higher purpose of bringing everyone to. So when you'd come, when tourists would come to Yerushalayim in those days, besides the spiritual visit to the Holy Temple, and besides the tour that they were given of the royal palace and all of its splendor, and the zoo and all the other things in the area, perhaps they'd have a chance to meet or to hear about the wisdom of Shlomo, this wise person who's presiding over this great city, which is at the center of this great nation and this great empire, all devoted to the higher purpose of the king of the world, king of the universe. Shlomo was a very young person when he became king. He's described, we'll see a little bit later on this morning, he's described as Na'ar Varach, very, very young and tender. According to the rabbinic tradition, he was 12 years old when he became the king, which would mean he died at the very young age of 52, because he ruled for 40 years until his death. The Tanakh itself does not tell us his age when he became the king. He's the only king, as far as I know, in Sefer Melachim, whose age is not given to us. And if we therefore want to, you know, look for other possibilities besides the rabbinic tradition, he could have been somewhat older, but not much. Because David ruled in Yerushalayim for 33 years until his own death. Shlomo was born during those 33 years. And he cannot have been born at the very beginning of them because there are a number of things that had to happen before Shlomo could be born. I'm not going to go into the whole chronology of David's life now. We discussed that a bit last year, some of us. But in any case, maybe he could have been 20. Maybe a little bit older. Not much beyond that. Which would mean that he only lived into his 60s. Meaning whatever he accomplished at a young age and in a fairly short span of time. Okay. So this is the great and glorious picture of the snapshot. We're going to have a chance to look at a lot of this in much greater detail, but the snapshot of this 40-year period in our national history. And of course, as was already hinted at, you know, the question is going to have to be asked, you know, what went wrong? Because shortly after Shlomo's death, very quickly after Shlomo's death, this entire thing collapsed. And the nation split into two, and thus began a process that took several hundred years, but a process that of degeneration that ultimately resulted in the entire destruction of the nation and the kingdom, and exile from which we have not yet completely recovered. Right? So there are really two twin questions we need to ask. How was all this accomplished? And unfortunately, why didn't it last? But before we can zoom in and begin to look at Shlomo's life and this time period directly, we have to understand, you know, how we got here. So let's take a few minutes and just go back to the beginning. And let's do a very brief summary of the history of the Jewish people according to the biblical narrative from the very beginning until the time of Shlomo. Let's try to do that in about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Oh. And we'll start, conveniently enough, with this week's parsha. No, I was going to say the Jewish people. This week's parsha, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, arguably, the history of Am Yisrael begins in the Psukim that form the beginning of this week's parsha with the choice of Avram Avinu. And right there, at the very, very beginning, I heard it in Shul this morning. Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, we all know that Avram was chosen and given this mission, leave your family, leave your country, leave your society, leave everything behind. And God promised him all sorts of rewards for that. I'll make you great, and I'll make you famous, and I'll make you powerful, and etc., etc. But if you read carefully, from the very, very first moment, the very first words of God to Abraham, it was clear what the purpose of this was. V'nivruchu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama. Abraham was chosen not for himself. And he was promised all sorts of privileges and all sorts of rewards, but they were given to him for a reason. And he is going to be blessed in order that he bring blessing to the entire world, to the entirety of humanity. And this is not the time to go into that, but if one reads carefully, that becomes the theme of the entire Torah. Those messages are refined further during the lifetime of Abraham and repeated again to Yitzchak and repeated again to Yaakov, and ultimately the Torah that's given in Har Sinai is the embodiment of that mission. Kohanim, Mamlechet Kohanim, exactly. Very good, exactly. Exactly. Attend to Mamlechet Kohanim, right? And a Kohen is not a Nazir. Kohen is not a monastic who hides away in the desert and meditates about God. A Kohen is a leader. A Kohen is someone who brings God's word to the people, right? Our Kohanim raise their arms at the end of the tefillah, or at the end of the service to Beit Midrash, to transmit God's blessings to us. And as was already mentioned, it is they who take our korbanot and put them on the mizbeach. Right? The Kohen is the one who brings God to the people and people to God. And when we were told, Batem Tiuli Mamlechet Kohanim, that was nothing other than the crystallization of the purpose for which Avram was originally chosen. Okay, but this is I've given a whole course on this, and if I keep on going, I'm going to speak the rest of the time about it. If you want to see a further application of it, take a look at Yishayahu Perek Bet, and you'll see the final vision of that, but that's not for now. B'chol ofen, Avraham was promised, again, right in the very first words we're going to read when he came into the land of Canaan, L'zarecha etein et ha'aretz hazot, and to your descendants I will give this land, and that promise, of course, is actually a double promise. because it includes, first of all, the idea that you're going to have descendants, which he at the time did not, and that you will be given this land. And later on, in this pasuk I did put on the page, the fourth source there, which comes from the end of the parsha we're going to read this Shabbat, the Brit Ben Betzarim. There, Avraham was promised, "Bayomahu karat Hashem et Avram Brit lemor lezarecha natati et haaretz hazot." Again, the promise that this land will belong to your descendants. But here, there's borders: minahar Mitzrayim ad hanahar hagadol nahar Prat, from the Nile River to the Euphrates River. I don't have a map here, but if you realize what we mentioned a moment ago, that geographic description from the Nile to the Euphrates is essentially, or at least almost, was accomplished in the time of Shlomo. Right? This promise that one day you will rule, or you will inherit the land from the Nile to the Euphrates is, Shlomo reached the Euphrates, not quite to the Nile, but basically to the edge of the inhabited area.
Where's the Euphrates?
The Euphrates River starts in southern Turkey, cuts through Syria, and goes into Iraq.
So all the way from southern Turkey.
The city of Tifsach, which is mentioned here in the second source here, Tifsach ad Aza, Tifsach is on the Euphrates River.
Why do we know that?
What do you mean, why do we know that?
Tifsach is not a city today.
No, but there's, there's like a lot of biblical places, there's different opinions about exactly where it is. I don't remember exactly, I looked it up, but it's in that area. And plus the other psukim that describe the countries that he ruled over, he approached the Euphrates River. I don't know if he got the, Assad that they were talking about wanted to dip his feet into the Kinneret Lake, right? He got upset when Bill Clinton offered him only 10 meters away or something like that, right? So I don't know if he was able to dip his feet into the Euphrates, but, certainly approached this vision of Minahar Mitzrayim and Nahar Prat in the time of Shlomo, and it's important to understand that for what we're getting to, because the concept that there's going to be a time when the Jewish people will inherit the land of those proportions and that those geographic regions was already mentioned from the very, very beginning to Avraham. But in that same vision to Avraham, as we will also read this Shabbat, he was told he was very frightened when he got that vision. Charada gedola imach chashecha gedola nafla elav, because it was in that vision that he was told the very, very terrible prophecy that his descendants are going to be enslaved and for hundreds of years in Mitzrayim. And of course, he wasn't actually told where it was going to be, but that's what happened. And as we know, of course, that is what happened. And then the Bible tells us after several hundred years of slavery, we came out of Mitzrayim amid all sorts of miracles and went straight with a few minor adventures on the way. Within a span of a few weeks, traveled to the foot of Har Sinai, and there we received the Torah, which, as was mentioned, was essentially the fulfillment or the crystallization of the mission for which Avraham had been chosen hundreds of years earlier. Now let's pause the biblical narrative for a second and ask not what happened next, but what was supposed to happen next, what should have happened next. Okay, Avraham was chosen, God gave him this vision, he explained to him, whether we understand it or not, that this is what's going to happen. You're going to inherit this land, and you're going to rule over this great empire, and you're going to influence the entire world for the good, but first there's going to be hundreds of years of slavery and exile. Why? Not for now, but that's what's supposed to happen. That's what happened. Now, we went through all that finally. We came out, splitting of the Red Sea, 10 plagues, the whole story. We come to Har Sinai, we get the Torah, Na'aseh v'nishma, we accept the Torah, we bring the sacrifices, conduct the whole ceremony. What's supposed to happen next?
Come into the land.
Straight. Directly. The Torah tells us, if you flip over the page, it's from the book of Shemot. This is Shemot Perek Chaf Gimel. This is before the Chet HaEgel. This is really part of the narrative of Matan Torah. This is part of the narrative of the initial covenant at Sinai. Hinei Anochi Sholeach Malach Lefanecha. I will send an angel or a messenger in front of you. There's a whole discussion about what that's referring to. Not for now. But the point is this messenger will lishmarcha baderech, will guide you along the way, ulahaviach el makom asher achinoti, and he will bring you to the place I prepared for you. Hishamer mipanav ushma bekolo al tamer bo, listen to what he tells you, follow my laws, ki lo yisal pishachem, I won't tolerate violations of the laws, but if you follow the laws, im shamo tishma bekolo, v'asita kol asher adaber, Ve'ayavti et oivecha ve'tzarti et tzorecha. God promises if you follow my laws, your enemies will be my enemies. Right? And you don't want to be on the wrong side of that equation, right? Being God's enemy. I'll take care of everything for you. Ki elech malachi lefanecha, my servant, my angel, my messenger, whatever it means, will go in front of you. Ve'viecha elayim oriba chitiba pritziva knani achiviva ilusi. You will enter the land inhabited by all these foreign nations. Ve'hichichaditiv, and you will eradicate them. You will inherit their land. When you do, the warning already here from the very beginning, when you do inherit that land and you eradicate these nations, don't absorb their values, don't worship their gods, don't follow their ways, don't adopt their culture, but rather ki hares tahasem, eradicate them, shaver tashaver matzevotehem, destroy their pagan worships, and instead worship God, and He'll give you economic prosperity. You'll have plenty of food, you'll have plenty of drink, you'll have no sicknesses, no diseases, and we've already said you'll have no enemies. In other words, what was supposed to happen straight from Har Sinai, we were supposed to take the Torah that God gave us and march with it straight into the land of Israel, follow its laws, and what would then happen? What would then happen?
Prosperity.
Economic prosperity,
peace,
tranquility, and eradication of all of our enemies, ruling over the entire rest of the world. In other words, what was supposed to happen right after Har Sinai,
it happened during Shlomo.
Only happened over 400 years later in the time of Shlomo.
Mm-hmm.
Or let me say it differently. What we have to talk for a minute about those 400 years, but what ultimately happened in the time of Shlomo, according to the original plan, should have happened straight from Har Sinai. It may have taken a few years. The Torah says in another place that the conquest of land is supposed to happen slowly and in stages. It's not going to happen in one instant. But it's clear that the amount of time it should have taken is measured in years or in decades, not in centuries. And in any case, it's meant to be a perhaps somewhat slow, but steady and definitive process with no hitches and no bumps in the road. Okay, so let's, before we talk about what did happen, let's continue what should have happened. So they would have left Har Sinai, they would have followed the Torah, God would have taken care of everything else, His angel or messenger in front of them would have, you know, won all the battles for them, and they would have had peace and tranquility and economic prosperity and you know, a vast empire. And then what? Is that it? So now we just sit. Not so bad, right? And then we just sit down under the Geffen and the Teinah now. Well, there is one other point. What else are we supposed to do? Correct. The Rambam tells us it's not in those psukim. And to be fair, there's a little bit of a machloket Rishonim that I'm ignoring here. But the Rambam's position on this point, which is the one that's most commonly understood, the Rambam tells us, Shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael v'shav k'nisatan la'aretz. When the Jewish people enter the land, there are three mitzvot. And later on he explains that these three commandments have to be fulfilled, and they have to be fulfilled in sequence. It has to be this sequence. And it's very logical why. You'll see in a second what they are. The first one, l'mnot lehem melech. There has to be a king. There has to be a central government. She'ne'amar, he quotes the pasuk, som tasim alecha melech. And then lahakrid zaro shel Amalek. Then they have to defeat and destroy Amalek. Amalek being the symbol and perhaps the leader of all of our enemies. So we have to defeat our enemies. We have to have a period of peace and militant security. And then v'livnot lahem beit habechira. And then
originally God did not want a king. I mean, He condescended to Shmuel, one of the people.
Okay, very good. That's what I sort of hinted at when I said that I'm ignoring a significant debate. The truth is that there's what appears to be a contradiction in the Torah. You're correct 100% that the narrative in the book of Shmuel makes it sound like a king is not something that's good, that God, Shmuel was viciously opposed to it, and God told Shmuel, you have to listen to them, but seems to agree with Shmuel that's not a good thing. On the other hand, the pasuk that the Rambam quotes from the book of Dvarim seems very clear to say that there's a mitzvah to have a king. So the question of how to reconcile those two competing sources is a subject of significant debate, which I sort of hinted at the fact that I wasn't really discussing here, you know, because it would take us far afield. But you're 100% correct that there's a question on this matter. The Rambam, basically there are one of three things you can do. You can assume, as your question basically did, that the pasuk, the controlling, you know, the one that should set the tone for us is the section in Shmuel, right? And we start with the idea that the Torah is telling us the king is a bad thing, and then I have to go back and understand what those pasukim are in Dvarim. And if you read them carefully, there are other ways to read them. Maybe it's not a commandment. Maybe it's only a possibility or a permission, and that's what some of the rabbinic commentaries do. The other possibility, which is what the Rambam does, is to assume that really there is supposed to be a king. And then the question is, why did Shmuel and God himself react that way? And what the Rambam does is interpret those psukim by saying that the problem wasn't the very fact that they wanted a king, but the reasons they wanted a king, the way they asked for it, perhaps the timing of it. In other words, that the problem was local to that situation, but not to the concept itself. Admittedly, that's not the way the text there sounds. On the other hand, when you read the text in Dvarim, it sounds very much like that is what's supposed to happen. So you have to reconcile those two things.
In a way, it sounds like it's condescending. You know, the people are getting unruly and whatnot.
Right.
And okay, it's the same thing almost like with God saying, okay, you can eat meat during the time you know.
Right. Exactly. So the Rambam says that he, you know, I didn't put it on this page, but a few sentences later, in that same text, he asks, so if there's a mitzvah to have a king, like I just told you, why did Shmuel get upset? And he says he got upset because of the way they were asking. Exactly like you said, you're being unruly, you're being, right? And it was that he felt that the request was coming from insincere motives and perhaps ulterior motives. So then the problem was the way it was done, but not the etzem fact that there should have been a king. But there's definitely other ways to read it, and there are those who disagree with the Rambam. In any case, we'll see also in a minute, the book of Shoftim also, though, seems to support the Rambam's reading. We'll get to that in a minute. But it doesn't have to. In any case, so, assumedly, this is what should have happened. They should have gone from Har Sinai into the land of Israel. They should have appointed a king, or perhaps some other form of government, which is what those who disagree with the Rambam would say. And they should have defeated their enemies, which God promised them would happen fairly effortlessly, and then they're supposed to build a Beit HaMikdash. Then they're supposed to build a house for God. The Torah doesn't tell us where. The Torah simply speaks about the place which God will choose. And God eventually did choose Yerushalayim. Or maybe he had already chosen Yerushalayim and he revealed it later on. And then, what's supposed to happen next? Well, that's what happened. That wasn't what was supposed to happen, though, right? What's supposed to happen next?
World peace.
All right. I guess we then go towards the era that eventually became known as the Messianic era, Yemot HaMashiach. That's a term that doesn't even appear in Tanakh. That's a rabbinic term, but it doesn't matter. The vision's in Tanakh, right? And the vision's even in the Torah itself. And elaborate on in many of the prophets, especially Yeshayahu, but also others, etc. Okay, that was the plan. But of course, it didn't happen that way, right? And the first thing that went wrong, as you mentioned, is the golden calf, the Chet HaEgel, which was the first failure of the Jewish people after receiving the Torah, right there while still standing at the foot of Har Sinai. That caused a delay of at least several months. And perhaps, depending... correct. Correct. And depending on how you understand it, may have caused certain other changes, but... Okay, right. In the scheme of things, had that been the end of it, lo nora. Okay, then came the sin of the spies. That already caused a much longer delay of 40 years. An entire generation that would have to die in the desert, including Moshe himself, not leading the people in, but the next generation under the leadership of Yoshua. And then, as the book of Yoshua tells us, they came in, the next generation came into the land, and at least in the beginning, things seemed like they were going according to plan. They managed the beginning of the conquest of the land happened miraculously and fairly effortlessly, and things are supposed to proceed now, according to, okay, so we had a delay of now 40 years, still not so bad in the scheme of things, right? Certainly compared to 400 and certainly compared to 3,000, right? Okay, takala, right? You know, little bumps in the road. What went wrong in the time of Yeshua? Why didn't it work out then? Well, not only with the Givonim, but with also the other nations, right? In the book of towards the end of the book of Yeshua, God criticizes the fact that, you know, they didn't, as soon as they were able to kind of sit down and they had enough place to live, they didn't finish the job of conquering the land. They didn't want to deal with all the nations. They made agreements with them. They let them stay. And then they began to be influenced by those nations, exactly what the Torah had warned against. And this becomes then the theme of the entire book of Shoftim for the next several hundred years. The second chapter of the book of Shoftim lays out the pattern, which is played out again and again and again throughout the book. There is no central government in the time of the Shoftim. The people are sitting, as you say, tachat gafno v'tachat te'enato. And everybody's doing kind of their own thing. And for a while things are good, and then they begin to become influenced by the culture of the surrounding nations, and God has to get involved, and he sends some enemy or another to oppress them, and then they cry out to God, and then he sends a shofet, a local leader, to, you know, solve the problem, and then everything gets good again. And then we have a period of several hundred years, which the way that the book of Shoftim describes it was a downward spiral. Chronology of Sefer Shoftim, that's not for now. But the bottom line is, the story is told at the end of the book of Shoftim. The horrific stories of Pesel Micha and Pilegesh Begiv'ah, and the civil war that came as a result of it, you know, demonstrate both the moral depths and the spiritual depths to which the people sank, and the very, very real threat that existed to their very national fabric, and the possibility that the Jewish people would just disintegrate or assimilate or kill each other, who knows what. So from the vision of Avraham and the heights of Har Sinai to the end of the book of Shoftim, we have a very, very, very deep fall. And the book of Shoftim ends with a very, very famous statement that sums up the entire time period. And again, gets back to the question that we were discussing briefly a minute ago about whether we're supposed to have a king or not. Whether we are or aren't supposed to have one, whether it's ideal or not, the book of Shoftim tells us very clearly what the situation was. Bayamim ahem, this is the last verse in the book of Shoftim. Bayamim ahem, ein melech ba'are, b'Yisrael. There was no king in the Jewish people. Ish hayashar be'inav ya'aseh. And therefore everybody did it as he pleased, and there was anarchy. And therefore, whether one thinks, as the Rambam does, that a king is the ideal, what the Torah wants, whether perhaps a king is a necessary concession, as Shmuel HaNavi himself seemed to think, it was certainly a necessity. And it is with this that we enter the time period covered by the book of Shmuel. And the book of Shmuel tells a much happier story. A story of climbing up from the depths, back to the point where we're going to enter the life of Shlomo, who appears right after the book of Shmuel. The book of Shmuel tells of the time period that was led by three great leaders, one after the other. The first one, the prophet Shmuel himself, who seems to have begun the process of reversing all of these negative trends and of returning the people to the proper path. Unlike the other Shoftim before him, he didn't contend himself to simply dealing with a local problem at a local time in one particular part of the country. He viewed himself as a spiritual, not a political, a spiritual leader of the entire nation. He traveled around the country preaching and guiding and judging, and his whole birth into this world came in sort of miraculous circumstances, and in a way that made him stand. It was he who gave the horrific prophecy to the priest Eli, to the Kohen Gadol, the high priest Eli, that his entire family was going to be eradicated, that the Mishkan that had stood in Shiloh for a few hundred years was going to be destroyed. And of course that prophecy came true. And with that, Shmuel, after that terrible destruction, Shmuel was able to begin the process of rebuilding. And it was Shmuel who then, ultimately against his will, as was mentioned, anointed the first king Shaul and the second king David. Shaul, just two words about Shaul. Shaul, if you read the Tanakh at face value, Shaul, who was the first king of Israel, is described as a failure. And of course, ultimately he did fail. But, and we, those of us who learned this last year, had a chance to discuss this in a little bit of depth. If you read between the lines, that's only part of the story. I don't want to use the term distortion, God forbid, to describe the Tanakh, but it's deliberately highlighting certain aspects and deliberately because of the message that the book wants to give. But if you read carefully, Shaul is a much more complex figure than that. And although he ultimately failed in his mission, he was actually an incredibly successful king who really built the Jewish kingdom. Shaul took over a nation that had no central government, and he built a central government. When David became king, he took over an existing country. Shaul built an army, a standing army, that was sort of handed to David afterwards. Shaul began the process of defeating the enemies. When Shaul became the king, the nation was occupied and subjugated by the Philistines. And he liberated the people from the Plishtim, and the Plishtim never again were able to recapture the land, even though they tried a number of times. So Shaul was an excellent political leader, an excellent military leader, and even an excellent spiritual leader, in spite of his flaws. But I won't go into that in greater depth now, but if you read carefully, the indications are there. So Shmuel and Shaul, and ultimately then David. And David is the one, also anointed by Shmuel, to really, really lift the people back to the heights they were supposed to be on. David is the one who captured Yerushalayim. David is the one who made Yerushalayim into the capital of the Jewish people forever and ever. David is the one who defeated Amalek. Shaul was supposed to. And his failure to do so is ultimately what brought him down, or part of what brought him down. I think it's only part of what brought him down, but that's another story. David is the one who ultimately, very symbolically, if you read carefully, as Shaul was fighting his final battle and dying his tragic and heroic death on the Gilboa, down in the south, it was David who was wiping up the last vestiges of Amalek at the very same time. Which means that at a certain point in time during David's reign, he realized that the first two of the three steps, because clearly David learned the Rambam, right? The first two of the three steps delineated by the Rambam. They came into the land, they were supposed to have a king, or they needed a king, however you want to read it, and that took a few hundred years, but it happened. Eradicating Amalek and the other enemies with them also happened in David's time. What's supposed to happen next? The Beit HaMikdash. And David wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. And again, those of us who learned this last year, we saw that David not only wanted to do so, but took a number of practical steps. First and foremost, bringing the Aron to Yerushalayim, which was meant to be the first step in that process. And in a very public ceremony, bringing the Aron with great fanfare to Yerushalayim, establishing a place of kavod for the Aron in Yerushalayim, establishing a permanent rotation of Levi'im to sing songs in front of the Aron, even as the rest of the Mishkan remained at that time in Giv'on. And David then wanted to continue the process and build the Beit HaMikdash. And he expressed that desire to the prophet Natan, who in his initial reaction was very positive on the idea, but then received a prophecy from God that this is not meant to be. And told David, and we're going to look at those psukim in a few minutes, told David, it's not going to be you, it's going to be your son. Okay. So David brought us to the threshold, right? Back, one can say that at the end of David's lifetime, the nation finally was back where they were supposed to have been 400 plus years earlier, right after the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. And all the mistakes that had brought the people to the depths that were listed in the book of Shoftim seem to have been corrected, first by Shmuel, and then by Shaul, and finally by David. And when Shlomo ultimately ascends the throne, so what have we seen so far? Before we even get to Shlomo, and the question of, and this is part of what I meant at the outset when I said that it's not so much about Shlomo, it's about the entire nation which he led at a certain point in time. The beginnings of the answer to the question of how is Shlomo able to accomplish all this is that most of it had been accomplished
by David.
By David, and before him by Shaul, and before him by Shmuel. And we'll see that even more than is we're seeing now, everything was ready. We'll see that David had prepared. Well, okay, we'll get to that in a minute. But
he handed the kingdom on a golden platter.
Not just the kingdom, he was handed the Beit HaMikdash almost on a golden platter. All he basically had to do is push the button. Everything was ready, we'll see. So that's the beginning of this discussion. Shlomo is the fourth in a series of four great leaders, and he stands literally on their shoulders, figuratively actually, on their shoulders, and it was his task to bring to fruition the process that the three great leaders before him had had laid out. But in a few minutes before we end today, we're going to start looking at Shlomo himself, but just one other background point that I want to bring to the table here. If you look at David, one of the things that we discussed last year at the beginning, when we started learning about David, is that David was an unlikely choice for being the king. So was Shaul. Shaul didn't expect to be the king. His father and family didn't expect him to be the king. He didn't really want to be the king. At his own coronation, he went into hiding because he didn't want the job. David, who had a different attitude than Shaul, also, and was from the tribe of Judah, and there had been a tradition, but David was the youngest in his family, and nobody seemed to think, even when Shmuel came to the house of Yishai, David's father, and he said, where are all your... It's one of your sons, and he brought one son, not this one, not this one, not this one. He said, that's it? And then the father says, oh, well, there is one more.
He's the
little guy with the sheep, right? Beneath that, there's something deeper as well, which about David and his family, is that David has a number of... If you look at David's lineage and genealogy, there's a number of very, very unusual, one would almost say questionable... relationships that could and assumedly were brought by some of David's opponents to question his legitimacy. If you look at who David's ancestors were, on the one hand, he's a descendant of Yehudah, a descendant of Peretz, and those are supposed to be the, although that tradition wasn't universally accepted, certainly not by David's opponents, but at least according to the rabbinic tradition after the fact, that's where the king was supposed to come to. But if you look at David's ancestry, there are a few very, very unusual and questionable relationships in his past. Certainly, the Tanakh describes three. On his great-grandmother's side, we'll get to Ruth in a second, but her ancestor, of course, is Moab. Moab, who is born from an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. And that's one of David's ancestors, is Lot and his daughter, Moab. Another one, on his father's side, is Yehudah, in his relationship with Tamar. Also, not exactly conceived with what it seems Yehudah thought was a rendezvous with a prostitute. And then, the relationship between Ruth and Boaz itself, which also, came into being under what one might consider questionable circumstances. The rabbis add a fourth, one midrash we mentioned last year, also adds on the level of David's own parents, a whole story about Yishai having divorced his wife and her tricking him into conceiving another child with her by making him think she was someone else, and a whole rabbinic layer, at least according to one fairly late midrash, along that same theme. One needs to understand that as David's son, Shlomo comes to the throne with all those things in his background also. Those ancestors of David's are also his ancestors, and he has yet another layer. Because although Shlomo is the son of David, it's from which of David's many wives? From Bathsheba, the wife who has arguably the least legitimate reputation. Right? Again, we spent last year a number of classes trying to understand exactly what happened there and the different ways to look at it. But at least what it looks like to someone who reads the Tanakh, which at the very least is what it could look like to one of Shlomo's opponents, right? And I'm not saying this isn't what happened either. But at least the simple reading, we're talking about an adulterous relationship, right? Bathsheba was a married woman with whom David had an illicit rendezvous from which she became pregnant. And then, in order to sort of cover up for it, he managed to have her husband killed in battle. Now, Shlomo was not born from that pregnancy. That child died. I mentioned last year that according to Rav Yaakov Meidan, there may have been three other children who also died. That's not mentioned explicitly, but
from Batsheva.
From Batsheva, yeah. There's a hint in the.
Before Uriah was killed or after?
After. But before Shlomo.
How do they know the right?
Rav Meidan has this way of reading a pasuk in Devar Hayamim Shlomo seems to have had three older brothers. Well, the first child, the one that was that Batsheva was pregnant with from that original relationship, died after a few days.
And therefore, that was pure adultery. At least after he died, there wasn't
adultery.
It was just
right. Right, so that child.
Bad,
well, again, according to some rabbinic ways of reading it, it wasn't necessarily adultery, whatever. But I'm saying, bonagid, right, right. So, right, okay. So, according to pshat, that child would have been, let's say, a mamzer, but that child died. There are three other children that were born to Batsheva before Shlomo who have names in the Tanakh, and we know nothing about. If you look into Devar Hayamim, Batsheva, Shlomo was her fourth child, not counting her fifth child, right? Those other three children, we have absolutely no indication what happened to them. There's nothing told about them. And based on a way to read part of the Pesukim in the book of Shmuel, Rav Meidan, if you want to know the bottom line of it, if you remember, when when Natan HaNavi came to David and told him a story about a sheep and everything, David said, the person who did that should be punished. Arba'atayim. He has to be punished four times for what he did. And according to Rav Meidan's reading, those are the four children that died. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you could take that or leave that. But the point is that, okay, so Shlomo, right, by the time Shlomo was born, certainly Uriah was no longer alive, and David and Batsheva were assumedly married. But still, it's a relationship that David had other wives that perhaps might have seemed more appropriate to be the mother of
the future king.
First of all, he was married to Michal Bat Shaul, right? Yeah. That would have been, we talked about last year, how Rav Meidan thinks that was the original plan, yeah. Right? But for whatever reason, we talked about what it might be, she never had any children. He also had other wives, we'll see, already, God willing, next week, we'll see that some of his wives had been princesses or members of royal families from other countries, and the sons of those wives, certainly we'll talk about Adoniah ben Chagit. There was already prior to this the rebellion of Avshalom, whose mother was a princess from the land of Geshur, right? So I'm just pointing out that on the one hand, all the questions of legitimacy that David had to deal with, all of those are in Shlomo's background also, plus, right? And Shlomo has to deal with the fact that he's also a descendant of Moab and of Ruth and of Tamar. And on top of all that, he's also a descendant of Batsheva, right? And David. So on that level, whatever those things meant in the background of David, they also are there in the background of Shlomo. But on the other hand, there's something about Shlomo, about Shlomo's background, that's fundamentally different than both David and also Shaul. And that is, unlike David and Shaul, who were anointed kings in under circumstances that no one expected, Shlomo, first of all, was born a prince, was born and raised in the palace, and not only that, but although there were opponents and those who didn't accept it, it seems to have been clear, at least to David, and therefore, assumedly, to Shlomo himself, as soon as he was old enough to understand that he is the heir to the throne. When Shlomo was born, the prophet Natan declared, there's a pasuk, it's in Shmuel Bet, I didn't write down the source. Let me see if I can find it in 1 second, and then Perek Yud Bet pasuk chav dalid vayinachem David et Batsheva ishto vayavo eleha vayishkav ima vatelet ben. So David fathered another child with Batsheva. Vatikra et shmo Shlomo. Batsheva named him Shlomo. Vahashem ahevo, and God loved him. That's a very unusual expression, especially for a newborn child. Vahashem ahevo. God loved him. Vayishlach biyad Natan Navi. God then sent Natan Navi, the same one who had criticized David and warned David of all of the suffering that he was going to endure for his sins with Bathsheba and Uriah. The same prophet Natan was then sent to David to tell him how that Hashem loved this child. Vayikra et shemo Yedidya ba'avur Hashem. So Bathsheba called him Shlomo. His mother named him Shlomo. But Hashem named him Yedidya, which means the beloved of God. So, on the one hand, Shlomo has all the baggage that David had and more. On the other hand, Shlomo has something that neither of the two kings before him had. He grew up as a prince who was destined for greatness from the moment of his birth and was clear to his parents. And assumedly that became known to him as well. I mean, if he was only 12 when he became king, he didn't have that much time before that. But whatever education he had, it was with that very clear mission. He's called, he's born as someone who is the beloved of God, and who, as I'll show you in a minute, that David was told from the beginning that this is the child who's going to who's the one who's going to take over after you and is going to ascend the throne and is the one who's going to build the Beit HaMikdash that you want to build.
God likes baggage. God doesn't like simple, happy stories.
Beseder.
There is no biblical story that is normal. That comes from a normal family and normal, what we consider to be normal.
It's an interesting comment.
There's no trying to think of that. House is white picket fence and normal dad and home. Where in the...
That's a very interesting point. I never thought of that.
Which leader is, doesn't have baggage?
Wanted
the leadership.
Shaul didn't have baggage.
He didn't want the leadership.
He didn't want the leadership, but he's from a good family.
Right.
Wealthy family. Head of the tribe. He's tall. He's handsome. He's...
Right.
Oh, but it's a very valid point.
Like,
right. Valid point.
Sister. Like, what does that, you know?
Okay,
normal.
So there's something... Okay, there's definitely a lot there. 100%. 100%.
This is normal for God to pick someone.
Okay. Okay, so with that, we only have a few minutes, but I want to just get started. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we will look at the beginning of the book of Malachim Aleph, which discusses the transition of power between David and Shlomo. But we'll also look, and I want to start at least today, to look at that same period of time as described in the book of Divrei Hayamim. A word about the book of Divrei Hayamim. And those of us who learned together last year, we mentioned this there as well. The book of Divrei Hayamim, unfortunately, doesn't get studied all that much. And that's a shame. It's people don't study it maybe because it's the last book in Tanakh and people just don't get there. or maybe because people mistakenly think that... some people think it just contains a list of names, because if you read the first few chapters, that's what it has. So people don't read further than that, don't realize that it also discusses other things. Those names are also interesting, but that's not for now. And then people may think that whatever it says in there was already told to us in the other books anyway, so you don't need to read them. Assumedly, if it was included in Tanakh, it's because it has something to say. And although it does describe the same events that are described... Many of the same events, most of the same events that are described in the book of Shmuel and Malachim, it describes them from a different vantage point, and that's precisely what makes it important. It's telling the same story, just like we mentioned with Shaul, that the prophets, none of the biblical books are meant to be historical accounts. They're not history. They're commentaries on history. And they tell history from a certain perspective, and they highlight certain things, and they de-emphasize other things, and they sometimes even deviate from chronological sequence because they're not telling history. They're telling a commentary. They're explaining a perspective on history. And the books of Shmuel and Malachim describe those events from one perspective. the book of Divrei Hayamim, which was written several hundred years later, right? The books of Shmuel and Malachim were written shortly after, during or shortly after the time periods that they describe. The book of Malachim covers several hundred years and assumedly contains the prophecies of several different prophets who lived during those different time periods. The book of Divrei Hayamim was written in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, the time period known as Shivat Zion, after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and after the 70 years of exile in Babel, when the people returned to the land. And they needed a different perspective, a different, it's not prophetic any longer, but a different perspective that became included in the Kitvei HaKodesh, understanding their own history. These people returning from exile needed to understand who they were, and that's part of the concern for all the names and the genealogies at the beginning of Divrei Hayamim. They needed to understand who they were. They needed to understand what their connection to this land was, what their legitimacy in this land was. Not all that different than a lot of the questions that we ask in our generations, because we are also a generation of Shibat Zion, of people who are returning from the exile and questioning, do we have a right to this land, and what's our purpose here, and what does it mean to be a Jewish nation or a Jewish country, etc. So it's from that perspective that the book of Divrei Hayamim is written. And Divrei Hayamim de-emphasizes or completely ignores some of the events. Some of the passages are word for word almost, parallels to the earlier narratives, but there are things that are discussed in the earlier passages that are just completely ignored by Divrei Hayamim. For example, the whole story of David and Bathsheba and everything that came afterwards, Avshalom, etc., is completely absent from Divrei Hayamim, on the one hand. On the other hand, Divrei Hayamim discusses a lot of things that that the earlier narratives do not. I guess it's from here that we're going to have to start next time, but even just a few, you know what, just the psukim that are on this page. We'll pick it up from here, God willing, next time. The book of Malachim, as we will see, begins with David still alive, and with David giving his final, first of all, with a power struggle for the question of who's going to take over David's throne, a power struggle that broke out during David's lifetime, even, and within the beginnings of what could have been a rebellion against Shlomo, or perhaps an attempt to co-opt Shlomo and, you know, to sort of seize power before David died on behalf of Adoniyahu, and David himself getting involved and making sure that doesn't happen and giving final instructions to Shlomo. And the final instructions at the beginning of Malachim all have to do with taking care of unfinished, an unpleasant business from David's lifetime and taking care of some of David's enemies that David couldn't take care of, etc. And we'll look at that. One gets the impression that if one studies only the book of Malachim, then the entirety of David's instructions to Shlomo seems to be which people he should execute and who he should be concerned with and who he should trust and who he should not trust and how to avoid palace intrigue and how to avoid an attempt to overtake the throne. Important, I guess, but that's one side of the story. The book of Divrei Hayamim tells us about a different set of instructions that David gave to Shlomo, which are completely absent, not mentioned at all, neither in Shmuel nor in Malachim. And that is that David, who had wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash and who was told that he couldn't do so, and was told that his son Shlomo was going to do so, decided that if I can't build the Beit HaMikdash, and if my son's going to do it for me, okay, but I can get everything ready for him. Vayomer David, lichnos et hagerim asher be'eretz Yisrael. David gathered together all of the foreigners, that's how I think that word should be translated here, that were living in the land of Israel. Assumedly members of those other nations, either the local nations that they were ruling over, or perhaps representatives from other countries that were paying tribute. We talked earlier about, you know, providing not necessarily soldiers, but providing manpower for various projects, civilian service. Vayamed, from this, you know, koach adam, from this, you know, manpower, Vayamed Chotzvim, he took He took people, he appointed some of them as, or he set up teams of stone cutters, quarriers, who to prepare stones, lachtsov avnei gazit, to prepare the cut stones that would be used to build the temple, livnot beit ha'elohim, to build the Beit HaMikdash. So he commissioned quarries and quarry workers to get all the stones ready. Uvarzel narov lemismerim, and he ordered all kinds of iron for nails. L'daltot ha'sharim v'lemechabrot hechin David, and all the we're talking here about construction materials, right? Unechoshet larov emishkal, and incredible amounts of copper, v'atzei arazim, cedar wood, lein mispar. He imported from Lebanon very expensive wood. Why did he do this? Vayomer David. Shlomo v'ni na'ar varach. As we said earlier, that's the pasuk I was referring to earlier, right? He's a young boy. V'bayit livnot l'Hashem l'agdil l'mal l'shem u'tifer l'chol ha'atzor. And he has a very important mission to do. He has to build the Beit Hashem. And he's a little kid. I'm going to get everything ready for him. Vayachen David larov lifnei moto. David prepared everything before his own death. Vayikra li Shlomo v'no. He called his son Shlomo litzvayitzaveyu, and he commanded him livnot bayit ladonai Elohei Yisrael. So that's God willing, next week we'll look into this in greater detail. Just a word about about the class here. So as I mentioned before all of you came in, I hope this is going to continue. There is a minimum number of people. I'll have to discuss with the administration of Matan exactly what the minimum is, but hopefully, if a few more people join, certainly it'll be okay. And they said we'll give it a week or two. So I'm hoping this course will continue throughout the semester and hopefully beyond that, but we'll have
to... How long is this semester?
The semester goes, I believe, till beginning of February or something. It's all on their website. Mm-hmm. I'm not running the institution any longer, which I'm very happy about. I don't have all the details handy. Please bring a Tanakh to class, either with translation if you'd like or without. There's no need to prepare for the classes, but if anyone wants to, I'll try to just at the end of each class to throw out if you're interested in reading in advance. So if anyone is interested in reading in advance, really the entire end section of the book of Divrei Hayamim Aleph, basically from these pesukim until the end. You don't have to read every pasuk in detail. You could skim it. If you don't want to, it's fine also. But if you want to look at that and the first chapter or two of Melachim Aleph, that's fine also. And one other administrative note, there is 1 week, a few weeks from now, when I won't be here, which was listening to
October 31st.
Yeah, October 31st, yeah. Because, in this class I'm taking now, we have to do difficult things, and I had to go to a lot for 4 days. So
not bad.
Not bad. The truth